And then I jumped up, of course, after they passed, and we threw out our orange smoke again to show we were friendly, hoping this time they'd recognize what it was. And I put a field dressing with the idea of staunching the flow of blood on his neck. He couldn't speak because his vocal cords were obviously shot away. And he finished the O group, and I can see it just as plain as day, right to this very day, writing with a China graph pencil on the talc on top of the map to finish his orders group. And I had given him a shot of morphine to ease the pain, and of course you could see his writing trail away. Fortunately, we were close to the poles, and a first aid team from the poles picked him up and took him back. He subsequently died. But I thought it was a very brave thing to do, because most people, I imagine, when they're wounded, think of themselves, but he thought of the well-being of his squadron to make sure that I had everything that he had received from higher headquarters, which I thought was I was very proud of him, very proud of him.
Again, Harker describes, not in detail, of course, but that he was injured along with a trooper, Hallmark.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And
I tell you who was an observer to that particular scene is a chap that lives here in Victoria, Trooper Green. Mm-hmm. Cliff is his right name. Everybody called him Kitten. He was one of our very oldest and best of the troopers and covered himself with a great deal of glory later on. But he was actually in the tank that was sort of overlooking the O group where Worthington and I were standing when he was hit.
Now, there must have been some resentment against the American Air Force at this time.
Well, I don't know whether it's against the American Air Force or whether it was against the system that allowed us to. Maybe we were ahead of the bomb line at that particular time. I don't know. It's very difficult to lay blame. But it made us terribly cautious, let me tell you, because this is the third time within a few days that we had been either bombed or strafed by our allied air forces.
So all air forces were they not held in very high esteem, or do you think any bitterness? I know you're very you have friends in the Air Force and get along with them very well, and you talk very kindly towards them today, perhaps more kindly than others would. I'm just trying to think if there's any real resentment within the regiment itself towards air forces in general and flying officers and don't let them show their face around here type of thing.
Can't recall it. There might have been a certain amount of bitterness, but I don't think it ever got to that stage. We knew we were making mistakes, and we figured they made them too.
Okay. You, at this particular time, engage a heavy... Well, there's engagements all over, but there's a lot of dead prisoners and prisoners to pick up, and a lot of dead Germans and equipment and carnage and crap and corruption. I don't know how to describe it. Maybe you.
I was there, and I don't know how to describe it. It is just unbelievable, the amount of dead and dying Germans we found in this particular area. We were going off to Mount Ormel to push through a jock column to relieve the Poles who had been cut off in that particular area. And I forget the name of the town, but I remember that the people were moaning and groaning, lying by the wayside, dead horses, dead people, tanks overturned, supply vehicles lying in complete wreckage across the center line, the people begging to be helped, the Germans. We had a regimental medical officer by the name of Kaufman, and I remember he did his best with what limited resources he had to help the Germans, giving them morphine and trying to evacuate them, try to ease the suffering a bit. I'll also recall having to order my troopers to bury some of the German dead because we were afraid of disease and so forth. We didn't know how long we were going to stay in that particular area. And I think possibly the first time that I've seen Canadian soldiers show a repugnance towards war and all it stood for. I think an awful lot of pacifists were made that day. It was just unbelievable. These were German people, even as you and I are, our same age group. And it was a dreadful thing. Dreadful thing. Seems so damned impersonal.
Now, you also, at the same time, there were pockets of, Panthers, ADAs, anti-tank, Nazi fanaticals that were going to go to the last man. Hitlerjugend was around there. SS grenadiers were there. How did you feel? I'm thinking now of when you were going, we're talking about the opposition here, the enemy. Did you view them as regiments in different lights?
Oh, yes, no doubt about it. Everybody, right down to the last trooper, was anxious to know who was in front of them. Are you fighting the Schutzstaffel today? Are you fighting the 12th Panzer Grenadiers? Are you fighting the airborne troops? It became hard to say, but it was like you want to know what team you're playing against. You're playing hockey or basketball or baseball, you might want to know who the opposition is going to be.
And when you did find out about the opposition, was there great regard, say, for the paratroops or the grenadier panzers?
Yeah, and a certain dislike the members of the SS because everybody had known how the Schutzstaffel behaved. And
we got Kurt Meyer and the boys running around. Did you hear anything of that?
No, that the difficulties that Kurt Meyer got into were further back at Anchin-l'Abbé. And when he was brought to trial, it was over that, and really we heard nothing about it at that particular time.
Yeah,
it wasn't in our division. And
no, okay, I understand that it wasn't in your division, and it was more an infantry thing, but I'm just wondering if the rumors had spread that Canadians captured would not be alive. There would be no live prisoners taken.
No, I can't remember having anybody say that to me.
Okay. Also, did you do any special preparation, or did you know your opposition well enough to know his weaknesses, per se, if you knew what group it was?
At that time, I had very great difficulty finding any weakness in the German forces.
With the fighting withdrawal, as you said?
They fought a beautiful withdrawal, and of course they had such severe casualties when they withdrew from the gap.
Well, they were fighting their way out of the gap.
Yes, they were.
And I guess that was some pretty fierce fighting.
Yes, it
going
was.
Down. But I'm thinking, you were mentioning, I believe it was off tape last time, and I wish to get it on, that by the time you had grouped to take on a pocket, that the pocket was no longer there. Is that
that was later on, when we made the breakthrough after Falaise and the Swan towards the Seine and the Somme beyond. To hold up our progress, you would find just about last light, and this happened time after time, you would run into a pretty strong resistance. And by the time you got yourself deployed to go into action and got some artillery support to go to fall down on the enemy's head, the guys had disappeared into thin air. In other words, they stopped you, inflicted as many casualties as they could, but didn't want to have too many casualties themselves.
You know, profit loss ratio.
Exactly. And they did it extremely well. You have to admire them.
When do you get down to Falaise itself? Now, this would be, you went up to relieve the Polish division at Mount
Ormel, yes.
And I gather you were running into 88s there as well.
Yes.
How did you view the 88 as a tank, Commander, because I guess an 88 could open it up like anything.
With supreme apprehension. You saw the results of what 88s had done to your tanks when you saw them on the battlefield strewn around with holes in them. And you knew that it was a gun that had not only a extremely good armor-piercing shell, but also had a very good fire control system, and therefore it was very accurate. And that was a fearful thing. We learned techniques how to winkle them out, you know. And one of the things that I've said many times, and I guess I've said it to you on tape many times, is the fact that we have no conception, most people, of how flexible armored forces can be. And down at Fort Knox, Kentucky, at the armored center, you have a Sherman tank outside the main gate, and it said, "This is the tank that won the war." Mm-hmm. Well, that's I think the infantry won the war, the Air Force won the war, the Navy won the war. We all helped win the war. But I can see what they meant, that we had so many of them, the product of a good
industrial base.
We had a lot of them. They were extremely mobile. Automotively, they were quite sound. The gunnery system was not as good, but later on we put, as you know, 17-pounders, 105s. At the end of the war, we had a melange of various types of Shermans with various types of gunnery systems on them. And as a consequence, it was a good mobile tank and very flexible in its application. And therefore, if it was a static 88, as many of them were, remember that the German army, despite its feigned mobility, a great deal of it was horse-drawn. Exactly. And they would bring their guns into positions, horse-drawn, and we found with a tank like the Sherman, you could swan around a bit and get shooting at them from all sorts of angles and frequently knock out the gun and take the crew even without infantry support. And of course, when you had infantry support with you, you could shoot them onto the gun position with very, very great accuracy.
Well, when an 88 hit a Sherman, understanding, taking into account distance and all these other things, but say it really, a knockout punch, what kind of damage was done to the tank, the Sherman itself?
Depends where it was hit, you see. If it was hit in the sponson, was hit in, let's say, in the ammunition basket, it would blow. And particularly later on when they had phosphorus shells for them. Sometimes if it was just a glancing blow, it would knock off a track or something like that, and you had an opportunity to abandon before she went up. But they really brewed. We used to use the word brew, and that's what they did. They just brewed up. There was a flash of flame, and...
Well, when it hit, would it just burn its way through, mm-hmm. or just cut its way
cut through? Cut its way through, and the armor...
But the armor just wasn't sufficient to...
Oh, no. And particularly at the ranges that they were firing, because they were not about to give away their gun positions firing at long ranges. They tried to get you in as close as they could before they opened fire. When you saw tanks blazing away all around you in a tank battle, as you frequently did, it was an awesome sight, knowing that most of these casualties were being inflicted by a superior weapon system.
Well, how did you feel when you ran into the Tiger itself with having an 88, and here's something that can move maybe not quite as quickly or as well as you, but could move, and had the great armor as well, and yours would not bounce off particularly, but...
Well, there were places where it was vulnerable, and here again the supreme mobility of the Sherman. I've often thought it would, not that I've ever been in a naval battle, but it would be like a battleship being fought by destroyers. And you could swan around and get yourself into position. You might lose a tank or two in doing it, but you would be able to get eventually a vital shot away into a vital area of the Tiger tank and knock them out.
Now, what did you consider vital areas when you were firing at a tank? Did you have that much opportunity to go for an area or just the tank itself?
The tank itself most of the time, but you aimed at what you considered to be vital area, the ring between the turret and the sponson, for instance. You always wanted to destroy their visual systems. You wanted to get rid of all their periscopes and things of that nature, and you also tried to knock off tracks to make them immobile. But tank gunnery became a fine art. When we firmed up during the winter months on the lower Moss River, I had been back teaching crew commanders at a divisional training school that I commanded for a while during that lull in the battle. And we also got ourselves a tank training range up in Holland. And we did some pretty intensive tank shooting. We at the school taught them the fundamentals of tank gunnery, but then they went up and practiced on the range, and I must say the accuracy of our tank fire and things of that nature, the application of fire generally, mm-hmm. was much better after our firm up during the winter on the lower Moss.
Fale itself, what do you recall about that?
Nothing. We didn't. I personally didn't go into Fale. That was the South Alberta Regiment, I believe. Isn't that where Curry won his VC? It's in that area someplace.
So you just—I'm thinking of the gap and the closing.
It was the predominant thought that sticks with me now was the carnage and the people dead and dying.
And you feeling virtually helpless, I guess, at the same time, to do.
Well, as I say, our medics, I think, did an extremely good job in relieving suffering as best they could.
When you ran into Americans after this episode, was there any where were you guys type of attitude from them?
No, not at all. In fact,
I've been to the famous complaints. You know, that the British and the Canadians didn't get there soon enough.
They were the generals warring. There's an old Russian proverb, you know, that when the nobles fight, it is the peasants that get covered with blood. And this is the same thing. These were the high-level people fighting. But certainly there was no animosity between the American soldier and the Canadian soldier when we met. I think it was at Pont de l'Arche just before we crossed the Seine in that area. A great deal of swapping of rations and even weapons. We used to have the long barrel 38, you know, which we wore strapped to our suit, the leg of our tank suit. And my gosh, the Americans thought that was just gung-ho. We were training these 38s, which were absolutely useless as a weapon of war, to them for Tommy guns and things of that nature.
Good stuff.
and training our compo ration for their fancy field ration, which was great fun.
What were the great differences now? You're under a British system, basically. I mean, your combined British-Canadian system versus the Americans with what? Were the turkeys coming up for Christmas dinner?
The one Christmas that we were there, we did have a Christmas dinner, even though the Ardennes offensive was on. And I remember eating my Christmas dinner in the turret of my tank. But I remember that every trooper in my squadron had a turkey dinner. So the whole thing of cooking and eating in a tank regiment is the greatest of fun. Because, you see, you used to get the compo ration, and very, very seldom did you get a hot meal come forward from the echelon, because mobile warfare dictated that you had to eat on the run. And, of course, trying to get the tank crew, and there was no James Beard's book on the fear of frying or anything for us in those days. We had what was in the box of compo rations. But it was amazing with some of the guys, if it was your day to cook, and everybody had to take their turn. You see, every night when you firmed up, you had to, first of all, dig under the tank so you'd have a place to sleep. And then you'd have to prepare a meal of some sort. And one incident which I think is worth recalling, even though it's not worth putting on tape, was I remember we got into Belgium, and we'd been living on nothing but compo rations, and here we were in Belgium at the time that all the fruit was ripening and the tomatoes in the field and so forth. And I asked my FHQ wireless operator, it was his day to cook, and I said, look, here is the day that we are going to have a decent meal, and it's your day to cook. And we had fresh eggs, and we had fresh tomatoes, and we had lettuce and everything. He fried the whole goddamn lot. And if you haven't lived until you've tasted fried lettuce. And I often thought, you know, they must have been a Machiavellian bent to him, because we never asked him to cook again. Yeah. He always going next your wireless set.
Fry up all those fresh goods.
Broke our heart.
Okay. Well, I think we're close to the end today, sir.
Yes, and I'm lapsing into my anecdotal
rather than... No, that's fine. What I'm thinking of is that we'll leave the tractables a success, the Fowley's Gap is finished, and we'll pick up next day. Well, it'll be coming into the fall, fall of 44.
Well, I think it might be of interest when next we meet, Chris, to describe one battle that lives in my memory, because I was commanding a squadron at that time. My squadron commander was left out of battle, and I was commanding the squadron on the road between Les Essarts and Monet after the breakout at Falaise.
Well, could we discuss that now, sir?
We could, yes. This is once again where this fellow Kitten Green that I was referring to, mm-hmm. a trooper, he won a brilliant military medal in that particular action. But what actually happened was we were far, far ahead of everybody else. We were really bashing on.
What day were you talking, approximately?
I think it was, according to refreshing myself from the military history, it was on the 23rd of August.
Mm-hmm.
And Harker describes the various actions that won Kit Green his military medal on his book, The Jukes, on page 254. And I can tell you that that citation is exact because I wrote it. And because I was right with him at the time. But what happened there is we were far out of range of anything in the way of support. We had no contact with the cab rank to call down air support. We were far, far ahead of both the towed and mobile artillery, and as a consequence, I came up on the blower. I was commanding a squadron at the time, to our colonel and said where we were, and he said, bash on, and I said, well, I don't believe that bashing on is the thing to do here. We're running into a certain amount of resistance, and we were on one road. There was no question of being able to swan off either side of the road, and each side of the road was those beautiful big trees that they had in France, in that part of France, so that you couldn't get a tank off the road between the trees. The trees were so close together. And I was told that not to worry, that the Manitoba Dragoons had been through there and ran into no resistance at all. Well, what happens when the Germans are fighting a rear guard action and they're waiting to clobber the main body? They frequently allowed the reconnaissance to go through, and they were not about to disclose their position to knock out armored cars when they knew, because their intelligence was good, that right behind them was going to be a tank column. So I was told, have no fear, the Manitoba Dragoons have gone forward and they only lost one car, and they've everything's fine. So I said, an order is an order, but I would like some artillery support. I was told there was absolutely no chance of getting artillery support. They were miles and miles back. So we bashed on, and of course what the Germans did, quite rightly, they let me get my squadron nose to tail down the road about, maybe 100 yards interval at the very most, some of them 50 yards apart, and then they knocked off the back one, and they started to knock us off like ducks in a shooting gallery. And I must say that that was one of the days that I would have very gladly gone back to becoming an infantry officer again, or going back to my beloved machine guns or something of that nature, because it seemed to me just so futile to use an armored formation under those circumstances, to accept information from the reconnaissance forces that there was nothing there when we should know by this time that the Germans allowed the recce to swan through. A series of articles written in the Legion magazine by that NDP politician who is now a journalist.
Fisher.
He was in the Manitoba Dragoons, and I was going to write a rebuttal. But then I said, what's the use of doing this? Because he was saying how slow the 4th Armored Division were to react to the information that the reconnaissance were sending us. Well, of course, they were sending you duff information. Or not duff. They didn't know it was duff.
Yeah.
But they just didn't understand the German tactic. And that particular day, I lost practically my whole squadron.
You didn't have the weight
to push over the trees?
No, they were tremendous trees. And what they had done was they had, were firing on fixed lines, because when we eventually won the battle, at great loss and great cost, we found that they had the fixed lines marked through the trees, you know. They'd have the gun situated on the flank, and as soon as you got to that particular point, they just fired on fixed lines. Boom, right in the center of your tank.
Yeah.
And it's worth reading Doug Harker's account. As I say, I was jocular when I said this, that I wrote the citation for Green on that particular day, but it happened exactly as it is described in the citation, because I was with him all the time. I'd lost my own tank, and I was lying in a ditch.
What did Green do? First of all, we'll do, what did Green do to, as you say, cover himself in glory? And then number two, well, how did you react to the situation?
Well, I think it's, rather than put it on tape, if somebody would read what Harker says about it, it is just about as gallant an action that I have ever seen. I think I recommended him for a DCM, but he got a MM instead. You very seldom got DCMs or DSOs or things of that nature unless the battle was a success, and this one wasn't a success.
Yeah.
But
you were covered in this particular action yourself.
Oh, yeah.
You've just described. Mm. What happened there? I mean, granted, how should I put it? I've never been inside a tank when it's been hit. Now, presumably you were...
Oh, man, to that. It's awful. The point is that, in this particular case, we had a drill. If your tank was knocked out,
yeah,
as an officer, you took, if you were a troop commander, you took the platoon sergeant's tank.
Yeah.
He took the, at least the troop sergeant's tank. He took the troop corporal's tank. In other words, you...
Sort of bounced.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And in this particular case, as soon as I was hit, I took my FHQ sergeant's tank, because he was the one that was with me there, the fighting headquarters sergeant.
Yeah.
And eventually maneuvered it around and got back and regrouped at the end. But by that time, I forget the number of tanks we lost, but I think it's in the good book here. Well, I can, you can look that up, I think, if you want to.
Yeah.
But as I say, you've got Trooper Green here in town, and maybe for the point of view of real living history, to talk to a lad who was involved in that particular incident, and as I told you before, was involved in the incident when Jack Worthington was killed.
Yeah.
Close up in both cases. It's quite interesting.
Well, what did you do? I mean, they nailed your last one. They had you cold turkey. It's what, shooting fish in a barrel.
Exactly.
Almost.
Exactly.
Well, you've got it described. You can't. We need to start firing madly.
Yes, but then again, being very careful, because the trees being so close together, that you weren't about to fire HE against the trees and have it come back on you and your troops.
Mm-hmm.
I know when I abandoned my tank when I was first hit and got into the ditch, before I could see where my FHQ, that they had Panzerfaust along the line.
Is that how they were hitting you?
No, no, they were hitting us from the... But they had for close-in protection.
Yeah.
Now, those fellas all fled, of course, after they'd taken a shot or two. I've never known how many of the tanks were lost to 88s, how many were lost to Tagger, because there were Taggers dug in that particular area, and how many were lost to Panzerfaust. It'd be an interesting operational research study to find out just how many. All I recall was the fact that it was impossible to swan the squadron, to uprise, as we called it, you know, to get off the road. I must tell you a silly story about uprise later on. But it was impossible. We eventually got two or three tanks turned around and went back out of the range of the fire, and we saved a lot of people, and because of Green, we saved some more. Strange enough, one of the chaps, a fellow by the name of Lance Corporal George Roy, he was the gunner in my tank, and he got hit in the head by spalling. You know what spalling is? When you hit a tank, the little pieces of steel, iron inside, flake around. And he got hit by a piece of this spalling on his head.
Yeah.
And the gray matter was oozing out of his head. And in this particular case, Green and I together put a field dressing on his head, and bandaged him up, gave him a shot of morphine, put the, you know, you wrote on indelible pencil on the guy's forehead at the time you had given him morphine and how many grains you had given him, and nested the casualties, as they're called, put them in the center, to be picked up by the medical people. I never thought he would live, and he just died about 4 weeks ago. He was blind, but he ran the CNIB stand in one of Montreal's big office complexes downtown. He used to write to me every year, He was legally blind, but he could see a bit, and he used to write to me every year. We've exchanged from that day on. He always thought I saved his life, and I always thought he saved mine. So.
I'll be damned. Mm-hmm. I'll be damned. Well, again, just in the last few minutes that we have, you were hit by a shell,
yes.
AP shot, presumably.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Side or front?
In the, just over the track, between the track and the turret. It wasn't enough to knock the turret off. It twisted it, but it didn't knock the turret off. So it was an AP shell. It wasn't a phosphorus or a...
Did it penetrate?
Oh, yes. That's what caused the spalling inside, you see. But fortunately, we lost a lot of people, including some very good ones, in the other tanks. But in my tank, the only lad was the one that was hurt with the spalling hitting him. It's amazing how fast troopers learned to get out of a tank when it was hit. We used to joke that if somebody came and hit the side of the tank with a ball-peen hammer, everybody would be out through the tank and the crew commander's legs. You'd lose the operator and the gunner would come up through your legs. they were so trained to get out. You know, there's an escape hatch in the bottom and you used to be able to go out that way.
Yeah.
But 9 times out of 10, you didn't fumble around for the escape hatch. You went up through the turret.
And you had, you'd have the turret, the driver and co-driver, they had a little hatch?
Yes, they had hatches. And once again, you see, we're talking about going in closed down.
Yeah.
The average driver, of which this chap Green was one, would very, very seldom keep his hatch down. You know, you have to get down and look through the vision blocks and so forth, and they would much rather take a chance and have good vision.
Yeah. I'll be damned. And this is in action itself.
In action itself.
When this happened, though, when you got hit, was it just a resonance? You couldn't hear anything, or what?
Oh, deafening. Deafening. You shake your head for days after.
Eyeballs would be rattling. Eh? Mm-hmm. You figure that was it, or what?
Oh, no, when you find out you're all in one piece, you know.
When you hear it.
And boy, you abandoned ship in great hurry.
Then what? Then you would crawl out. Now they'd be what? Were they raking with machine gun fire as well?
Yes, we were, and that's why we were in this ditch at the side of the road while all this raking with machine gun fire and so forth was going on. But as I say, I crawled up the ditch and got into another tank, and eventually was able to turn it around, and we got pulled a few tanks out. But this was a dangerous operation because you were jinking back and forward on this one road trying to turn around.
Yeah. It always amazed me, quite frankly, that with all those damn shells racked around the inside of your turret. How you can be hit and how anybody can survive.
Earlier on, Chris was asking me this, and if you got a direct hit in that area, the thing just brewed up like a Roman candle. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
And there, very few people got out. Maybe the driver and the co-driver, if they were lucky, because they were sort of in a separate compartment for them.
Yeah.
But usually got wounded in the legs, even though they got out.
Yeah. Well, Chris, I think we better call this session to an end.
Thank you very much, General Tedley, Dr. Roy.